The title of this talk is Cool Things About RNA, and it I think it stems from conversations I had with Terry when he was visiting MIT maybe 6 months ago or something, and we were discussing RNA splicing, and then told him a little bit about RNA interference, which is something not in the textbooks, discovered about 2 years ago. A very, very interesting phenomenon. And then it occurred to me that maybe I should talk about some other interesting phenomena related to RNA besides splicing and RNAi. So I'm also going to talk a little bit about ribozymes. And this is also fairly recent work, a little bit from David Bartel, and also the structure of the ribosome was solved, and it was shown definitively to be a ribozyme. That is, peptide bond formation is catalyzed by RNA, not protein. And so anyway, but before I do that, because I didn't quite finish my last talk, I thought I would just finish up a few loose ends from my talk on Monday. Specifically, I talked about this algorithm genome scan, and so I'm just going to briefly mention just a little bit of data from genome scan. Then I'm going to talk about trying to figure out the RNA splicing code briefly, the rules for how you go from pre-mRNA to mRNA, which is a main interest of my lab. And then I'll switch to the cool things about RNA for the remainder of the talk. And I should emphasize that the cool things about RNA section is not my work. It's collected from the recent literature. So yesterday I talked about genome scan, our algorithm for predicting genes in the human genome using a combination of ab initio, that is modeling of sequence composition, and using protein sequence similarity. And I somehow neglected to show that the accuracy of this method. We've tested it on several data sets, and the accuracy varies as a function of the sequence, the similarity of the protein that you're using to help infer the gene, as you would expect. And so on this axis is the level of protein sequence similarity of a protein that you're using to help predict genes in a genomic sequence, expressed as the minus log of the BLAST p-value for homologous protein that you're using to the true protein encoded by that gene. And so in this area, where you have only moderate similarity between the protein that you're using to help the predictions, the performance of genome scan is similar to gen scan. So gen scan here is shown in orange. That's the an ab initio method. Here's genome scan. And then for comparison, here are two methods that basically align bits of the genomic sequence to the protein. So they're more based on sequence alignment, almost purely using the similarity aspects and not the ab initio. And you can see that they don't really give you very much coverage of the exon. So on this axis is the exon level sensitivity, that is the percent of the true exons in a sequence which are correctly predicted, and they don't cover very much of the exons until you get very high sequence similarity on the order of 10 to the minus 80 or 10 to the minus 120 p-value. But what you see here is that when you have a moderately similar protein, and this is relatively common to have an available protein, say from mouse or fly or some other organism that is, say, has a p-value of 10 to the minus 50 or something, then genome scan does find a significantly higher fraction of the exons, maybe close to 90% instead of maybe 80% in this data set. And I should emphasize, this is a relatively easy data set of about 175 genes, genomic sequences each containing a single human gene. This is the Brissette-Gigot data set. Anyway, if anyone cares about that. And this just compares the specificity also. That is, what fraction of the predicted exons correspond to true exons. And again, genome scan has a significantly higher accuracy than gen scan, and especially in this typical region of moderate similarity. So just for completeness. Yeah, that's right. Gen scan doesn't use sequence similarity. So this is just sampling fluctuations because there are roughly 100 sequences in each of these sets. We didn't always have a homolog in the appropriate p-value range for each of the 175 genes. So yeah, that's sort of fluctuation due to limited sample size, but yes. Okay.
More highly conserved genes are also, on average, were more highly expressed, so it might have stronger signals.
you might see a slight upward trend. Yeah, there is maybe a slight upward trend here, and it's possible that that's going on as well. Yeah. I haven't really looked at that systematically, but it's a good point.
Yeah. It was useful to actually use a sequence profile beyond to combine lots of sequences
rather than just a single protein sequence. That's somewhat similar to what GeneWise is able to do when it uses a PFAM model of a domain or of a family of proteins. And we have not done that, although GenomeScan is able to take similarity. We use BLASTx of the genomic sequence against a database of proteins, and so you can give it many proteins, and you can have many proteins with overlapping hits. So you can give it the whole family of proteins and look at all the hits in the genomic sequence, and then it just takes the strongest hit in each region. And so it could potentially be taking hits from different members of that protein family. And so it's maybe not the ideal way to use that information, but it uses it to some extent. But that's an interesting thing to explore,
when
I think.
The limit of very, very high similarity is we don't get 100% correct information.
Okay, that's a good question. There are some very small exons, sometimes, maybe 10 bases, and these may not give a hit. But even alignment programs like GeneWise can't necessarily find every exon, even given a very, very high. Or another issue is that you may have a protein which is, say, the gene codes for a protein that's 700 nucleotides. You have a very, very close homolog over 700 amino acids. You have a very close homolog over 500 amino acids, which gives you, 10 to the minus 120, but it still doesn't cover all the exons. So that's, we've explored, you could say, well, you shouldn't use the log p-value as your criteria. Maybe you should use percent identity or something like that. And you can use that too, and you get qualitatively similar results. But yeah, that doesn't mean it's identical over the entire length. Well, it's first of all, it's not that strong. If you have to look at a lot of BLAST hits to know what a 10 to the minus 20 hit looks like. It's not. This is across the whole length of the protein. That's the strong. That's the total p-value. And so it's not that strong. And usually, it's only giving you one or two exons. And apparently in this set, they were the exons that were being predicted already. And so it didn't really help. Something like, you get basically the same plot. Another reason why these weakly similar proteins don't help much is because the information doesn't just come from the fact that you have a BLASTx hit here. It also comes from information like the fact that you have a pair of hits that are adjacent in the target protein. That helps the algorithm to not predict exons there. That's used to. You can't see anything. Is there a place I could? What if I stand over here? Okay, sorry. So the algorithm is using the information positively to say, okay, if you have a BLASTx hit here in the genomic sequence, there should be an exon here. But it's also using it negatively. So if you have a pair of strong hits that are spaced apart in the genomic sequence but adjacent in the protein, then the inference is that there are no exons in between. Okay? And so that information, you don't get that kind of information until you get high sequence similarity, because then you have to find both of these hits, and the hits have to match up very well with the protein. Does that make sense? So there's more. You get the program is using more different types of information as the similarity gets higher. Okay. So and we've also tested this on draft sequence and so forth, but because this is a, I want to move on to other topics, so I won't dwell on these accuracy numbers. The Guigo data set that they tested the Questes and GeneWise on. Roderick Guigo had a paper from last year where they tested similarity-based gene finders. Yeah, I can give you the reference.
Okay.
Okay, so here's our data on finished and graft. The accuracy in finished sequences, we made a set of genomic sequences, each containing one or two genes, which have been sequenced in finished form, that is complete contiguous sequence across 200 kb, roughly, and also had been sequenced in draft form, that is by the public, that is in little pieces. And then we mapped the exon locations onto the finished and draft sequence, and then looked at how accurately we could predict the gene structure in the finished and draft. And as far as I know, this is maybe one of the only published measures of accuracy of a gene finder on draft sequence. Nobody has really dealt with this issue, I don't think. And so this just shows that in terms of the exon level sensitivity, the percent of exons predicted exactly, this is for genome scan now, you do better on finished than draft. You miss more exons on draft sequence. In some cases, this is because the draft sequence just doesn't have that exon. So that's one issue. It just missed in the assembly, say not even sequenced. This is about roughly 4x coverage draft. So this is a typical of what's available from the public data. It's not super high quality. And in some cases, it's just that because it say only had one or two exons, then say those individual exons were not similar enough to any protein to trigger a hit, and therefore they were missed. And so you do suffer a lot in terms of sensitivity from having draft sequence. This is in terms of exact predictions. In terms of just whether you overlap the exon with the predicted exon, you do much better. So, and then this is in terms of the specificity. Again, you do somewhat better in finished for the most part. But these numbers are rather low here, but we think there are a lot of other genes in these sequences that are, you know, we're somewhat limited in terms of what sequences we had available, which had been sequenced in finished form and draft form and had a full-length cDNA, so that we had about 200 sequences of that type. And those sequences, of course, 200 kb is a big region, may contain other genes. You know, we didn't necessarily know that. And so there's other predictions which are being counted as wrong here, but some of them could be right. So these are sort of lower estimates.
Where did you get draft form?
Just from, you know, the web. HTGS. HTGS. The HTGS partition of GenBank has draft sequence.
But you have the example.
Okay, when we ran genome scan on the genome, we used the assembled draft, but this was just based on the draft provided in HTGS form. So low quality draft. We wanted sort of lower bounds on our accuracy. Okay, and this just describes how we ran genome scan on the genome. We ran it on the September, the Golden Path assembly of public draft and finished sequence done by Jim Kent at UC Santa Cruz. And this is what we got, 38,000 complete and partial genes. A lot of partial genes because of the fragmentary nature of the data. And we estimate about 11% pseudogenes and a few percent false positives. And we have a script that does this, and it's totally automated, so it just takes maybe, you know, an hour of a person's time to, you know, set it running, and then when it's done, make sure that it ran correctly. But it's fairly computationally intensive. It took about a few days on a 100 alpha processor machine. Most of the time is taken by doing blast searches against the protein database, as you might expect. The genome scan itself is only about twice as slow as GenScan, so it's relatively fast. Okay. Yes, and I mentioned yesterday the ExoFish approach being done at Genoscope, where they compare human genomic sequence translated in all frames to rough draft genomic sequence of the pufferfish, Tetraodon, chosen because it has a small genome, about 400 megabases in size, and it's been sequenced at around 0.4x by the French group Genoscope, and they found that TBLASTx hits between human and fish with appropriate parameters and appropriate cutoffs are always exons. So TBLASTx means translated in both genomic sequences. You may have a match at the protein level. And if you set the parameters appropriately and the cutoff appropriately stringent, then every hit is an exon. Of course, not every exon gets a hit because it may not be conserved enough between human and fish, but it seems to be a nice conservative way of identifying exons, and importantly, it doesn't really depend directly. It doesn't depend directly on expression at all because you're using genomic sequence. You're just using the fact that exons are conserved. So I think it's a nice method. Much shorter, much shorter. Yeah, but that doesn't really affect it because we're just comparing exons. And so they call these regions of similarity between human and fish that meet their criteria ecores for evolutionarily conserved regions, and they call their method exofish for exon finding by sequence homology, which I think is very clever. certainly one of the better names in the field of gene finding, maybe up there with Grail or something else. And so they to calibrate their method, so they use this method to estimate the number of genes in the human genome in an article in Nature Genetics, which I think is in the same issue that Phil Green published his estimates, and they actually got similar numbers, roughly 30,000. And so I think these are if you want to read, we haven't had much about that, but about how to estimate gene numbers, I think those are the two. Definitely two papers to read. And the way they calibrated their method was they took 10,000 full-length human cDNAs, this is as many cDNAs as we have available, so that's a full coding sequence of a gene. They did T-BLAST-X against the 0.4x of the fish genome, which they have, and they counted how many ecores there were per cDNA. And they found that on average you get 3 ecores per cDNA, that is basically 3 of the exons. So remember, a human gene has maybe 9 exons or so. 9 of 10 on average. On average, 3 of those give you hit in a fish. Some cDNAs might give you 6, some might give you 0, but on average it's 3. And then they just counted the number of ecores in the human genome. Okay, by taking the human the public assembled draft plus finished human genome, T-BLAST-X against the 0.4x fish genome, they got 90,000 ecores. Therefore, they infer that there are about 30,000 genes. So it's a nice simple method. It does have various caveats, and a major caveat is that it assumes that these 10,000 full-length cDNAs that we have are sort of representative of all the human genes that we know of in terms of their likelihood to have ecores. And if they're more conserved than typical, then this would tend to underestimate the number of human genes. So, if they're longer, that's true also. Right. So, and then they used this in a paper that's, which we collaborated with them on, which is submitted, to calibrate the completeness of the annotations of various genomes, including the C. elegans genome, the Drosophila genome, and so forth. They say, how many ecores are there, say, in the Drosophila genome? What fraction of them fall within annotated exons? And the answer is 95% or something, a very high fraction. And then they use that to, and we have now some annotations of the human genome. Of course, the quality of the sequence is not quite as good, and we're still sort of learning how to annotate it. It's very complicated. But they use that to calibrate two annotations of the human genome. So our annotation, based on the genome scan program, they found that 65% of the ecores fall in genome scan exons. And now this is in the draft sequence. When we look at finished sequence, such as chromosome 22, we get a higher proportion, closer to 90%. And they also found that 46% of ecores fall in ensemble exons. So ensemble is this project at the EBI, also aiming to annotate the genome. And so we think that our data set is more complete, but still not totally complete. Clearly, this analysis suggests that maybe we're missing about a third of human genes.
So how many ecores on average do you have per genome scan predicted
genes? It's smaller, but the genome scan predicted genes are often partial genes. I forget, it's 1.8 or something like that.
I was thinking you could maybe, if you assume the 3 per gene holds up for the whole genome, you could maybe refine your gene estimate by dividing the total number of, I don't know. You could adjust your estimate by maybe that would give you some.
So that's an interesting idea. We estimate that in these 38,000 predicted genes that I mentioned, which are complete and partial genes, we estimate there are about 1.5 predicted genes per gene because of the fragmentation. And
I guess
it's roughly consistent with the E core. It's roughly, that gives another way of estimating. Now, I'm not sure what to do here. Any suggestions? F8? F5? That's a screensaver? Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not so bad. Okay, so that concludes the gene finding section of this talk. And now I'm going to talk about the problem of RNA splicing, which I mentioned a little bit yesterday. And so, as we know, eukaryotic genes mostly contain several introns. Human genes, on average, contain about 9 introns per gene. And what that means is that the DNA sequence is initially transcribed into an RNA sequence known as the pre-mRNA, or the primary transcript, which is subsequently spliced to give the processed mRNA, which then codes for the protein. And this process of splicing occurs in the nucleus, and then the mRNA is exported to the cytoplasm for translation into protein. And the parts that end up in the mRNA are called exons, and the parts that are cut out and thrown away are called introns. And there are two popular models of RNA splicing called intron definition and exon definition. These are terms originally proposed by Sue Burgett at Baylor, who is actually the first author on the paper that discovered splicing, although she didn't get the Nobel Prize. And she noticed that in lower organisms, you often have short introns and long exons, and in higher organisms, you have short exons and long introns, and proposed that in lower organisms, you use something called intron definition. And I hope people can see this a little bit. The idea, I'll try to make it big, is that you have factors that recognize the two splice sites at opposite ends of an intron, and then they pair across the intron and splice it. And this seems kind of so obvious that it's not even a model when you first think about it, until you think about the alternative, which is her exon definition model, which says that the factors which recognize the splice sites at the boundaries of the introns actually pair first across the exon. Okay, so this is a complex, say, that recognizes the 3' splice site at the right end of the intron, and that complex would pair first with the complex at the downstream 5' splice site. Okay, and then subsequently, in a later step, these complexes would then associate across the intron. Clearly, they have to associate across the intron in order to splice the intron at some point. But so this is the exon definition model. And the key piece of evidence that distinguishes these two models is what happens when you mutate a splice site. Okay? So suppose you introduce a mutation into the primary transcript, which knocks out this 5' splice site. So I showed yesterday that there are some sequences, like the GT, which are essentially completely conserved. If you knock out either of those two bases, say change the G to a C, it's non-functional as a 5' splice site. And if you make that mutation, under the intron definition model, the expectation is that you should still splice out this intron, but not splice out that intron. So you would get an mRNA that looked like that, okay? Intron retention. Under the exon definition model, you would disrupt the formation of this complex. This complex would still form as with this one, and then you would get a splice like that. So you would end up with exon skipping. And the observation in human mini-gene constructs where these types of experiments have been done is that exon skipping is far, far more common than intron retention. In fact, happens roughly 50% of the time. And intron retention happens perhaps 5% of the time. And then other interesting things happen in the remainder of cases. And this is similar to what's observed in human genetic mutations. So roughly, it's estimated 10 to 15% of human disease-causing mutations affect splicing. Many of these occur in the splice site sequences, as you would expect, and often these lead to exon skipping.
So this is for higher organisms in general?
This is in vertebrates. It's very, this phenomenon is observed. In Drosophila, it's somewhat intermediate. Sometimes you see exon skipping, sometimes you see intron retention. Drosophila has a mixture of long and short introns. I'm not sure about the data in C. elegans. Do you know? No. Okay. In yeast only has one intron per gene at most, and its exon definition doesn't really make any sense. Yeah, right. So it uses intron definition. So the idea is that Some organisms use intron definition, some organisms use exon definition, some use perhaps a combination. And these models are still, they're a little bit vague anyway, you know, they're not really mutually exclusive models. And then exon definition has certain problems too, although it does explain the data much better than intron definition for human. How do you splice, you know, the last exon and the first exon, because they don't have the appropriate sites to pair with. The theory is that the complex at the polyadenylation, the site of polyadenylation, mimics the effect of a downstream 5' splice site, and there's actually some evidence for that. And the complex at the cap site, which is the first base of the mRNA, mimics the effect of the upstream 3' splice site. And so the first and last exons can also be spliced in a sort of exon definition fashion. So anyway, so these are the models.
So in the 45% of cases neither one of these, are those at least explainable in terms of exon definition?
Yeah, actually those are also more easily interpreted in terms of exon definition. Most common thing, I believe, is you activate a cryptic 5' splice site, which means an X there, but you activate a cryptic 5' splice site, say, you know, 20 bases downstream of the normal 5' splice site. And again, if it's exon definition, you expect it to be close, sort of close to this site. With intron definition, you know, you might expect it would activate the site over here, perhaps. Although, you know, then you could think you're stretching the models at that point. But anyway, generally you get activation of some cryptic splice site.
In these human genes with 9 exons or whatever, do you find a mixture of the same genes sometimes?
Mixture of short and long introns?
Yes.
Sometimes you do. But again, there are not very many short introns in human, so mostly it's the long introns. Okay. So that's about the level of theory that we have in RNA splicing. Again, I should mention also, as I talked about before, there are constitutive factors, the SNRPs, which recognize the 5' splice signal, the 3' splice signal, the polypyrimidine tract, and the branch signal, which is involved in catalysis. Basically, this base nucleotide here attacks this junction here in the process of splicing. I don't think there's been a slide on this so far, but the
SNRP is
close. That's pretty close. It's a small nuclear ribonuclear protein particle. Okay, so it's a complex of a small nuclear RNA. Which is, you can think of like a tRNA, it's about 150 bases long, with a whole bunch of proteins. So, and that's typical of many reactions involving RNA that are catalyzed by RNA protein complexes. And the mechanism of RNA splicing involves a nucleotide near the 3' end called the branch site, which is almost always an A. And the 2' hydroxyl of this nucleotide attacks this phosphodiester linkage here, and leads to an intermediate which looks like that. And then in the second step, you have ligation of the two exons and release of the intron as a lariat, which is then degraded. So there's a signal motif, which I'll show in a moment, at this branch signal, as well as at the 3' splice signal and the 5' splice signal. Okay. We think so, but it's not completely described. Yeah, one would expect that there would be. So one of the sort of proposed mechanisms, or something that makes exon definition more plausible, is the discovery of exonic enhancers, which are small motifs in exons, which are recognized by a family of proteins known as SR proteins. And these proteins have a modular structure in with one or two RNA binding domains and an SR domain, which is a region of serine arginine dipeptides. And this SR domain is known to be a protein-protein interaction domain, and it interacts with other SR proteins, so as shown here. And then one component of U1 SNRP and one component of U2 SNRP, the U1 70K protein and U2AF 35, also have SR domains. And the idea is that you perhaps have a complex across the exon involving these interactions between the SR domains of U2 SNRP, the SR proteins, and these with each other, and then with U1 SNP. And that sort of provides a sort of mechanistic model of how exon definition might work. Yeah. There are also intronic enhancers known. We often don't know what the factors that bind them are. Why?
How can you reconcile the exon definition with the branch?
Well, the idea is that you first do recognize the exon, and then later you bring this complex in contact with this complex across the intron, and then do the catalysis. So the exon definition would occur well before catalysis. It's a very early step.
Just recognize.
You form a protein complex, and then this complex then comes together with another complex, and then starts to do the catalysis, the two steps. So it's just a sort of a recognition step. Yep.
RNA. Okay,
so let me tell you a few things that are known about them. They're a medium-sized family, maybe 10 or so members, the different members in different species. They're found in every eukaryote except Cerevisiae, every eukaryote that has significant genomic sequence. And remember, S. cerevisiae yeast does not have exon definition, or exons really, just has one intron per transcript. And I'm just going to hit this. Okay, oops, I'll back up. And they're very easy to study because there's an antibody called MAB108, which precipitates the entire family of SR proteins because it recognizes this SR domain, which is they all have. And one of the early observations was that nuclear extracts, if you make them properly, can catalyze RNA splicing. So you can do in vitro splicing. You add primary transcript, do in vitro transcription, and then you can do in vitro splicing. But if you make them with S100, which is some detergent or something, they're not competent for splicing. But if you add SR proteins, purified SR proteins to that to the S100 extract, then they become competent for splicing. So the SR proteins are important general factors for splicing. And also, if you add any individual SR protein, any individual member of this family, it often restores splicing. So they're somewhat redundant in terms of their function. And they bind, often there are multiple sites per exon where they bind. They've been implicated in regulation of alternative splicing. They have a number of functions related to splicing. There's maybe 100 or 200 papers on them. They're quite well studied.
It would seem that whether it's exon depletion or intron depletion will have some interfering density between exon and intron.
Right.
Well, if it's exon depletion, then you probably don't want exon to less to be too wide.
Right.
Having narrow distribution.
Right. That's right. And the interactions that have been shown between SR proteins and recognizing exonic enhancers, they appear to fall off. If you make the space too far between the 3' splice site and the exonic enhancer, then the interaction falls off. So more than 200 or 300 bases, it falls off. And that's roughly the length, the sort of maximum length that you see.
Explanation for why you see very sharp distribution of exon size in human, but you see it's always exponential.
Yes, it's probably related. Yeah. That's probably the most widely accepted theory of that, although it's hard to prove.
Does our protein only bind exon sequence, or do they?
They will bind those same motifs if you put them into an intron, but their normal function seems to be binding exonic sequences. The motifs are sort of variable 8 to 10 to 12 bases long, roughly, and they're very fuzzy and degenerate. They're usually purine rich, meaning lots of A's and G's. But mostly mutations that say from an A to a G or G to an A will restore, will preserve function. So they're degenerate. Yeah.
If you look at a candidate for a
Meaning, if it has lots of enhancers and stuff in it? Yeah, well, the current model for alternative splicing, so the most common type of alternative splicing is exon skipping, okay? Where, say, this exon, you include it in some tissues and not in others, okay? In other tissues, you just skip over it like that, okay? And the current sort of belief is that what you do is you have weak splice sites here in the skipped exon, okay, weak 3' and 5' splice sites, and then you put an enhancer in it, which is recognized by, say, a tissue-specific protein, or a protein which has different concentration in different tissues, okay? And that's how you enable the splicing machinery, recognize it in some cases and not in others. That's sort of the standard belief for alternative splicing. But these motifs have also been found in constitutive exons. So, you know, in general, the alternative splicing and constitutive splicing are sort of, you know, very closely related. You don't necessarily use, you know, sort of special sequences for alternative splicing.
Have the motifs been defined precisely enough that you have the one-to-one correspondence between the motifs and the
motifs? To some extent, the early experiments, so Adrian Craner and Cooper, I don't remember his first name, are two of the main people who work on this. Adrian Craner did CellX, where he finds the winner binding RNA sequence, you know, the one that binds most tightly to the protein. He did that for some SR proteins and then put those winner motifs into exons and found that they actually killed splicing. And so the explanation was that maybe the SR protein is binding too tightly, something. So this maybe is a transient interaction or something like that. They find that the more fuzzy degenerate consensus you get from just a couple rounds of CellX, you know, works better. And they've also, he's since then done functional CellX where he's actually selecting for the motifs which activate inclusion of that exon in an SR-dependent way. So it's a complicated assay the way they do that. But they've now found sort of motifs like that. And so we have these motifs, but they're very, very fuzzy and degenerate. You know, 3 or 4 bits of information in an 8 or 10 base thing. It's really, you know, it's really weak.
Can you tell the difference between different motifs that are recognized by different
SR proteins? Yeah, they're somewhat different. There are the two main families of SR proteins which have somewhat different specificities, and some in members of those families, some are more narrow in their specificity, some are more broad. And we're starting to understand, but we don't quite have enough understanding where we could like really put it into a model. You could put it into a model, but it's not clear if it would work. Yeah. You're talking about mutually exclusive exons. Well, we have a database of alternatively spliced genes, and we counted up these events, but it's somewhat biased by what cDNAs you happen to have, and so, you know, we're not totally sure, but my just ballpark numbers would be maybe half of all alternative splicing is exon skipping, and then 10% might be this mutually exclusive exon arrangement, and then you also have alternative 5' splice sites. You either use this site or, you know, a site 15 bases downstream, or alternative 3' splice sites, or you skip a pair of exons or include the pair, or, you know, there's more complicated things also. Also, alternative promoters are very common, and alternative polyadenylation. And sometimes you have competing polyadenylation versus splicing kind of things, and so it's... Alternative promoters, you start the gene either here or here. The most common thing is you have two different first exons. I can draw that. So you have a promoter which says start transcribing here, and then when you transcribe there, you splice down to here's this exon, and you have maybe another promoter which says start transcribing here, when you transcribe there, you splice, say, down to the same second exon. This is relatively common. I know of a gene that has 12 different possible first exons, for example. And then alternative polyadenylation is the same thing at the other end. And there's actually a really nice example, the Drosophila DSCAM locus, which was recently described. There's a mini review in Cell, which is fairly accessible by Doug Black from late 2000, in which he describes the work on this locus. And it has something like 30 exons or something, but Exon 7, there are 48 different versions of it, and you only ever use one of those versions, so it's totally mutually exclusive, like you were mentioning. And then there's, you know, exon 11, there's 5 different versions. You only ever use one of those versions. And so the combinatorial complexity of this gene indicates that you can make something like 35,000 different proteins out of this one locus, and they comment that that's actually more proteins than there are genes in the Drosophila genome. So it's, or the human genome. Yeah, so it's potentially, they don't really understand why it does that or how important that is, but it's, it potentially can give you a lot of different function out of one locus. Could be. I'm not really sure. Yeah.
First of all, it's kind of slicing. How much is that regulated by other agents in the cell? How much of it is just
attractive? We don't know that. We know a few examples where it's very tightly regulated, but it happens roughly 50% of all genes in humans seem to be alternatively spliced, and we doubt that they're all tightly regulated. Some of them seem to be, like you see these two forms in every tissue, roughly the same levels, so we think it maybe doesn't matter. So it's unknown.
If you're regulated by what? If you have 48 versions, you need 48 more people regulated.
It's not known in that case. Yeah. Okay, so I told you about the splice sites yesterday, and the idea that alternative exons may have weaker splice sites. We're testing that currently to see if that holds up. And so what we wanted to do, our goal is to solve the splicing code, okay? So the genetic code, you give me a pre-mRNA, I can tell you what the encoded protein is, okay? And it's a one-to-one correspondence, or really, you know, three-to-one correspondence, if you like. And it has very, very few exceptions. The splicing code, you give me a pre-mRNA, I tell you what the processed mRNA looks like. That is where all the exons and introns are. And this code is going to be more complicated. We're far from solving it. And it's going to differ. It's not universal. It's going to differ between different organisms. We know that the splice signals are different. You put, you know, Drosophila gene and a human nuclear extract, it sometimes gets spliced correctly, sometimes not. You know, there are differences between the organisms, although there are also a lot of similarities. And so that's our main goal, is to come up with a set of rules which mimics what the splicing machinery does. So it's similar to gene finding in that we want to find exons and introns, but we don't want to use information that the splicing machinery is not using, like open reading frames and things like that. So what we wanted to do is first start on a relatively easy case, because we think this splicing problem is very, very hard. And we started on short introns in different organisms. And I showed yesterday the intron length plots. And I'm not 100% sure if I have that in this talk because of the PowerPoint, the laptop problems I was having. But anyway, you remember that there's a sort of a peak of short introns in C. elegans, Drosophila, and Arabidopsis, but not really in human. And so we said, and we think that these may be recognized differently, perhaps by intron definition, and that therefore they may be easier to simulate. And so that might be a good problem to sort of practice on. And so these are the signals that we know of, which are important for splicing recognition. The 5' splice signal at the 5' end of the intron. This slash indicates the boundary between the exon and the intron. The 3' splice signal, which in human and Drosophila consists of a polypyrimidine tract, CRT, Y represents CRT, followed by an invariant AG. Here's the exon intron boundary. And
small T means
less conserved, yeah. And like, for instance, this dot here, there's a non-conserved position here for some reason. Yeah, N is more standard. Yeah, I don't remember why I did dot here. R, yeah. I think I didn't have enough space when I put N, so I replaced it with dots. and the branch signal, which has consensus, something like, TAC-TAC in yeast, and it's something like CTGAC in human. And then perhaps a preference for a certain length, and perhaps features of intron composition. So now we're trying to splice short introns, and we're basically assuming an intron definition model, that's how they're spliced. Therefore, we're not worried about things that might be in the exons. We're only going to look at these signals and possibly aspects of intron composition. Yeah, I mean they're quite similar between species, but there are subtle differences. I'll show them in a moment. No. The branch site is present in every intron. It's just the signal, which the splicing machinery recognizes, that's associated with this A. It's just sort of a motif that's around this A, which says, yeah, where do we make the lariat?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I should have that on a slide, and it's found in every intron. Although it's possible you could use different branch sites and still the same three-prime splice site in there. Examples known of that. Okay, so here is the intron length distribution. Again, this is on a log scale, and it goes off the edge. There are bigger introns than 1,000 or 2,000, and roughly half of introns in the worm C. elegans are in this range of roughly 35 to 60 bases. Roughly half of Drosophila introns are in a range of 40 to 80 bases. Roughly half of Arabidopsis introns are between something like 60 and 116 or so. We fit two log normals to these. the fit is not, you know, is not great, but it gives a sort of rough correspondence to the distribution, and it gives us sort of a natural way of defining. We define the cutoff for short introns as the point where these two curves cross. You know, it's somewhat arbitrary, but it sort of gives us a way of defining what we mean by a short intron. Okay?
You're going to get a sum of two
log normals. Yeah. Sorry. Right. Yeah. It's you know, you could say that you could probably find a function that fit better, but you know, this is sort of something that fits, you know, roughly and gives us a way of objectively defining what we mean by a short intron. And I think it's best for these two organisms, and I think almost anything you use would give you roughly those same cutoffs here. And here it gets
a little bit. What fraction are in the
It's like 15 to 20%, something like that. I think. It's either 10, it's somewhere between 10 and 20. I don't remember precisely. Okay. So what we do is we're studying just this class of introns in each of these organisms. I'll explain in a second. Yes, and we're assuming intron definition. So you can have the 5' splice signal, branch signal, polypyrimidine track, 3' splice signal, and intronic enhancers, but nothing else.
Is that a reasonable assumption, or is it just?
There's some evidence. I mean, when people have looked at splicing of short introns, often you know you delete the splice or knock out the splice site, and it leads to intron retention. It's pretty reasonable. So how much data do we have? So this summarizes the amount of data we have for genomes, for organisms whose genomes are complete or essentially complete. This is just the size of the genome in megabases or millions of base pairs. The number of intron-containing transcripts that we have from that organism. This data is a little bit out of date. I mean, we certainly have larger sets now. The number of introns that these intron-containing transcripts contain. The average number of introns per intron-containing transcript. As I mentioned, in yeast, about 3% of genes have introns, and they just have one each. There's only a couple that have two. And so 97% of the genes in yeast don't have any introns. So we're only studying the ones that have introns. And then this is the percent of the introns that are considered short by our definition. So it's 10%. That's the answer. And it just shows that yeast, we don't really have much data because there's so few introns. But in worm fly, the plant, Arabidopsis, and human, we have large data sets of introns and large data sets of short introns, few thousand. So this summarizes the sequence motifs. I should have labeled the organisms, but I'll just tell you what they are. This is the yeast, S. cerevisiae, the standard yeast for genetic studies. This is a different yeast, S. pombi. This is C. elegans, Drosophila, Arabidopsis, and human. And the what we have here is the 5' splice signal. So the GT is the first two bases of the intron in every organism. You can see that these signals are quite similar across organisms, addressing your question, but there are subtle variations. You know, G is sort of more accepted in human at position +3 than in the other organisms, for instance. And this is the 3' splice signal. So you can see in human you have this pyrimidine track, lots of C's and T's, and then a YAG. In plants you have sort of a T track. It's not a pyrimidine track. And also in Drosophila and C. elegans you have a stretch of T's. And in C. elegans actually you have this very strong stretch of T's. You have positions which are like 90-95% T. I'm sure you know this, Bill. And so it's a more localized and shorter signal, but very strong. Has lots of bits, like 9 bits or something. And then in the yeast, you don't have much of a pyrimidine tract or T tract at all. And this shows the branch signal, which is this signal that's near the 3' end of the intron. Now, experimentally, what we do is we take cDNAs, we align them to genomic sequences. That's how we get our exon-intron structures. And that's sort of the gold standard for getting reliable exon-intron structures. But that doesn't tell you where the branch signal is. So we have to use some other method to figure out where they are. And of course, and experimentally, it's very laborious. We would like to maybe do an experiment and, you know, generate thousands of branch signals, but that would be prohibitively tedious. And so we use the Gibbs sampling algorithm to find the branch sites. We know from experimental studies that roughly where they are, they're sort of in the last, sort of from minus 40 to minus 10 relative to the 3' splice signal. We cut out that region of the intron and run a motif finder. And we find a motif, and this motif agrees pretty well with the experimentally verified branch signals in every organism except one. And it is, when we look at the distribution of where it is, it's roughly where the branch signal is supposed to be in that organism. And we think that the motifs we're finding are more or less the branch signal in most cases. And you can see in the yeast S. cerevisiae, almost every intron has the 7-mer tac-tac. So this is an extremely powerful piece of information about where the intron is, because a 7-mer occurs, you know, once every 16 kb or something by chance. And whereas in human, you have this very degenerate signal at the branch site. And these are all, it's known that the branch site is recognized by base pairing with U2 snRNA. Actually, you form a bulged duplex. So the A of the pre-mRNA actually bulges out, and then you form base pairs. So here's U2 snRNA here. Here's the pre-mRNA here. And you form base pairs on either side of this A, but then there's no base in U2 snRNA, which base pairs with this A. And so the A actually bulges out of the duplex. They've shown that this bulge duplex occurs in all organisms. The sequence of U2 snRNA is the same in all organisms in this region. And so you expect to have the same branch site consensus. And in general, if you look at this consensus, it actually is sort of, it's consistent with base pairing with U2 snRNA in general in every organism. Like there's a U here at this position for U2 snRNA, and that U can base pair with either A or G in RNA, and so that is why you see some Gs here. However, in C. elegans, we get this motif, and we tried cutting different portions of the 3' end of the intron and a lot of different parameters of the Gibbs sampler, and we always get this motif when we do any Gibbs sampling on short C. elegans introns, and we don't know what it is because it doesn't really look that much like the other ones. Phil?
I have not looked for the website. I mean, the only thing I've observed is, I mean, you do have an enrichment of A's around minus 15 or so. So it seems like the position tends to be, assuming that is the branch site, it tends to be in the position. I haven't looked at the that's where you're finding this motif.
Yeah, it's sort of minus 20, minus 30. Although it's found, these introns are very, very short in C. elegans. They're sort of, you know, 45 bases long. And, you know, so sort of in the middle of the intron somewhere. And if you look at the consensus for the 3' splice site in C. elegans, it's something like, you know, 4 T's and then a CAG. And this is actually very similar to the 3' splice site, except you have an A here instead of a G. And so we don't know if that means anything. These could be, you would think, maybe decoy 3' splices, except we know that you have to have an AG for 3' splices. So anyway, we're confused about what this is.
The transplant leaders actually
decoy 3'
Yeah, you should maybe talk to Tom Blumenthal.
Yeah, we're planning to do that. He's sort of the guru of worm splicing. Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, the first question we wanted to ask is, how much of the information for splicing of short introns is contained in these sort of classical splice signals? And so we, this just summarizes the amount of information, the relative entropy of each of those signals in bits relative to the background transcript composition of the 5' splice site, the 3' splice site in orange, the branch signal in purple. You can see it's very strong in these, and the intron length and intron composition. And for the branch signal, we corrected the amount of bits for the uncertainty in position relative to the 3' splice site. It's not really giving you as much information about where the 3' splice site is as the 3' splice site signal is. Oh yeah, SRBCA, yeast, worm, fly, plant, and humans.
Oh, plant.
Yeah, Arabidopsis, yeah.
So you have less contribution from the length and the elegans than the
Yeah, okay, so I should mention what I mean by this. So in this calculation, we take all the transcripts from the organism whose exon intron structure we know. We first throw away all the long introns, okay, as if they were spliced by some other process, which, you know, we don't understand. And then we're left with the short introns. And then we guessed that maybe there might be a preference for a particular length within that peak that is, you know, the mode of the peak might be preferred. And so if you assign a log-odds score to the for having this length distribution versus a uniform distribution over that range, we added a little score there just to see if that had any effect, and that doesn't give you much, not many bits in that. Okay, is that
so
clear?
It's relative to a uniform distribution over the width of that normal.
Yeah, that's right. So we're taking say in Drosophila it's 40 to 80 bases for short introns. Here's a uniform distribution, and here's the empirical distribution, and we just take the ratio of this divided by this and give a log-out score for that. That's just assuming a preference. And our idea here is we want to think of everything that might have an effect on splicing, and add it and take it away from the models and see how each can possibly contribute to the specificity.
So you're only getting a couple of bits, one or two bits.
Yeah, well, this is the amount of information sort of when you, how much you expect, just the relative entropy of that signal. And then we have another way of estimating the contribution to accuracy. So we put all these things into a model of splicing. We simulate, we make predictions in a bunch of transcripts using cross-validation, and then we measure how much each one actually contributed to the prediction, sort of using a regression. Simple regression model, and we get somewhat different relative contributions. So some of these that appear not to have much information seem to contribute more, basically because of dependencies between these different variables, and it gets complicated. But this is just sort of the crude relative entropy for each of these sources of information. Five times splice site is the donor site. Yeah.
A little less informative than
In C. elegans, the 3' splice site is very strong. But in other organisms, in yeast, the 3' splice site is weak. And in other organisms, they're usually roughly the same amount of bits. Like in human, the 3' is slightly stronger. It's like 9 versus 8 or something. It's the sort of order of magnitude the same. Okay. And then intron composition, I haven't said how we define this. We use a pentamer model, basically a log-odds score for each pentamer. And the score is determined by the frequency of that pentamer in short introns divided by frequency in the transcripts as a whole. Okay, so we're assuming that perhaps pentamers that are overrepresented in introns might be enhancers. That's the assumption. And those that are underrepresented might be repressors. And we assign scores in that way. Okay, so this is very, very simple. A simple model. Okay, and we just add up these log-odd scores. And then we use different combinations of the model. We use just the 5' and 3' splice sites, or 5' 3' and branch, or 5' 3' branch and intron length preference, or we use different combinations and see how well we do. And we measure the accuracy by, so the program is called Intron Scan, and we give it a primary transcript, which has had all the long introns already thrown away, so it just contains exons and short introns, and then we ask it to predict where the introns are, basically just using a threshold for what's the, you know, we score every possible intron. It's not a complicated calculation because there's a maximum intron length. And then we set a threshold and say everything above that score is a predicted intron, and then we compare those predictions to the true short introns in that transcript. And then we measure the accuracy in two ways. If, say, the true exon intron structure is shown by these red boxes, and if our prediction is exact, we call it an exact prediction. If our prediction got one of the boundaries right but the other one wrong, we call this intron detection. Okay, intron prediction, intron detection. Because we detected, you know, there's an intron there, but we just didn't get the exact boundaries right. And it virtually never happens that you get both of them wrong. And this is a summary of the performance of this method in predicting short introns in a five-fold cross-validated fashion. That is, we took our data set of known transcripts from the organism, broke it into five groups. You learn the parameters from four of the groups and test on the fifth one. And then we do that for each of the five groups and then average the results. And so in S. cerevisiae, we can detect about 90% of the introns with just the 5' and 3' splice sites only. But remember, the 3' splice site is rather weak. It's really most of the information is in the branch point. And when you add the branch point into this complete model, we can detect 98% of the introns in cerevisiae. So we've almost solved it there. But we can't predict the 3' splice site very well, because it turns out in yeast, the distance from the branch site to the 3' splice site is highly variable. It can be anywhere from about 15 bases up to over 100 bases. And so you have a very weak motif with not many bits down at the 3' end. And so there is a mystery. We can basically detect every intron. We get the 5' splice site right. We get the branch site right. But we don't always get the 3' splice site right in yeast. So we've sort of, in a sense, we've solved the problem. But in a sense, we're clearly still missing knowledge about how the 3' splice site is recognized. And we don't think that bioinformatics can contribute much to this, because there's only, you know, 150, 200 introns to analyze. And I think probably experimental approaches are going to be better to understand.
The biological purpose of this variant in this theory?
That's just the chemical mechanism of how it works. The
variant is universal?
Yes. Yeah. Right. And I may have a little bit more to say on that when I come to ribozymes later.
You should probably break at some point, because
yep.
I think the trading people are very aggressive about cookies.
Okay. We wouldn't want to miss cookies. So, the splicing part is almost done.
Oh, okay. That's irrelevant.
Just finishing the splicing part. We're free.
Maybe two, 3 minutes or something. Okay. So in C. elegans and Drosophila, we can detect a large fraction of the almost all the short introns, but we can't get them exactly right all the time just using the 5' and 3' splice sites. But when we use our complete model, which includes these three other factors, the branch signal, the intron length preference, and our model of intron composition, we can detect a very high fraction of the short introns and get them exactly right most of the time. And interestingly, in Arabidopsis in human, we do much worse. We only can detect about 80% of the short introns using these signals alone. But then when we use the complete model, we get a much higher fraction of introns in Arabidopsis. We're able to detect almost all the short introns, but not in human. And so it's interesting, what is it about this complete model that's giving us this large boost in accuracy in Arabidopsis?
Can you try these models on the larger response that are of similar?
Yeah, we have. And 40%, it's very low, yeah. So we have another model. We're going to have an exon definition model, and we're going to try that. And we think that'll work better for the long term. So we also did some simulations to determine how many bits of information you would need to be able to get a given level of accuracy in each of these organisms, assuming that you had two kind of fuzzy motifs, one at the 5' end of an intron, one at the 3' intron end of the intron. We generate random motifs of various strengths and then look at how accurately you and then put them in artificial transcripts and see how accurately you can get the splicing by using those motifs. And I should mention that when we report accuracy, it's the cutoff at which the sensitivity and specificity are equal. Okay, so we have a cutoff score for what we predict as an intron. If you lower that, you will get higher sensitivity, that is, get correctly find a higher fraction of the true introns, but you'll predict in general more false positive introns, and so we balance those and that choose that position for the cutoff. Is that clear? Okay. So this shows these curves derived by simulation for each organism. The reason that they differ between the organisms is because of the transcript geometry. Remember, there's different lengths of transcripts and different numbers of introns per transcript. The lower the density of introns, the more bits you need to find the intron, as you might expect. We tried to determine these things theoretically, and it's not as easy as you would think. But we have some theoretical curves which aren't too far off. And the interesting thing, I think, is that this shows how well we do with the simple model here with the triangles, and then with the complete model with the circles, and then you can compare it to the appropriately colored curve to see if it's sort of on track or not. And in general, we do better than you'd expect given the amount of bits in the signals that we're using. And that's presumably because of correlations between the signals. That is, when one of them is weak, the other one compensates and it becomes stronger. And it's particularly noticeable in Drosophila here and Arabidopsis. And this is just the same curve when you look at intron detection. And again, Arabidopsis, C. elegans and Arabidopsis are notable in terms of how far above the curve they are. And this summarizes the contributions of the different elements in our model to splicing accuracy. So we try the model with all possible combinations of the components of the model that we have. So, with the 5' and 3' splice site, with 5' 3' and branch, with 5' 3' branch and joint composition, etc., and use a simple linear model to estimate the contribution of each of those signals to the accuracy. And then we calibrate it to a 98% accuracy. We say 98% is, sort of a good level, perhaps close to what the splicing machinery itself can do, and that gives us a gray area of how many bits we're missing, sort of, from that organism. Okay, is that clear? Roughly? Well, anyway, and then, this tells us how much information we're getting from the 5' splice site, from the branch site, and the 3' splice site, and so forth in each organism. And the interesting thing is that, so in yeast, you get mostly from the 5' splice site and branch site. This is, we're measuring intron detection now, and so that's, branch site helps a lot with intron detection. In elegans, again, the 5' and 3' splice site contribute most of the information, similarly with Drosophila. But in Arabidopsis, you get an enormous contribution from this model of intron composition. Okay. In human, you also get a large contribution there, but there's an even larger amount of information that we basically don't know where it is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So the core components of the spliceosome are very highly conserved. U1, U2, U4, U5, U6 snRNAs present in all organisms and are highly conserved, especially the parts that base pair with the pre-mRNA are almost totally conserved. The proteins, are the SNRP factors, are also very highly conserved. And there's one protein, PRP8, which is like 80% identical between yeast and human or something like that. It's incredibly, incredibly high. Maybe 60%. Anyway, it's a very high amount of identity. So those core components are very highly conserved. But these sort of ancillary factors, these enhancer binding and repressor binding factors, may differ a lot more, and we know less about them. So I think that's what's going on here. And I think, in fact, in Arabidopsis, that you've got intronic enhancers, which are really playing a much bigger role in the recognition. The catalysis is still done by the same basic components, though. Does that make sense? Okay. So to try to address what we'd like is not to score for every pentamer. That's not very realistic. It's not exactly, you know, it's unrealistic that the splicing machinery is looking at every pentamer and, you know, giving it an energy that's proportional to its log-odd score. We'd like to have a simpler model which identifies, you know, exactly which motifs are contributing. And so what we did was we looked at the contribution. We just add a few pentamers at a time to our model. So first we use one pentamer. Just score for that one pentamer when it's present in an intron. How much does that give you? How much does that contribute to the accuracy? Then use another pentamer and so forth. We sort the pentamers by F log F over G, which is like their contribution to the relative entropy. And then we use, you know, here the first, anyway, the point is that from a baseline level of something like 86% intron detection, we can go up almost, and we can go up about 96% when we use all the pentamers, but we can go almost all the way with just a handful of pentamers, like 20 pentamers gives you, you know, 92% accuracy or something like that. And so we think that we can localize this effect to a very small number of sequences.
But is it, I mean, sort of what you're doing is you're distinguishing coding sequence from non-coding sequence. I mean, I think you want to be able to assume that these are actually signals that are somehow recognized by the splicing machinery, that they may just be intronic non-coding sequence looks like. So you're basically gaining your improvement in accuracy because you're excluding the coding sequence.
No, exactly. This is just a statistical, you know, measure, and you need to have more evidence that, you know, it might be recognized by the splicing machinery, but it requires more evidence to show that it is. Let me just show you what the transcript composition. Okay, so let me just show you what the pentamers are. So these are the top 10 intronic pentamers sorted by F log F over G in three different organisms. You'll notice in Arabidopsis, they're very T-rich. In human, they're very G-rich, and a lot of them have GGG in them. And in Drosophila, they're very AT-rich. And there's not many words, in fact, only one pair of words, that's present in the top 10 for both organisms, for two or more organisms. So these intronic words are very, very different between the different organisms.
So pentamers, like the balance point between available data and...
We have like 2,000 short introns, and they're short. So that's about as high as we can go. Yeah, we believe the motifs are probably bigger than pentamers. Actually, some intronic enhancer motifs, like GGG, is a known human intronic enhancer in human. So it's just a triplet. But other motifs may be, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 bases long. But pentamers is sort of something we can conveniently measure and is long enough that it has some, you know, this is slightly interesting. Okay. But as Phil said, you know, we think these are good candidates for intronic enhancers because they really help, you know, identify the introns. But to say that they are, you know, requires additional evidence. And we actually have additional evidence that they are enhancers, many of these, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Yeah. You mean like the Rockefeller people are... Yeah. UCSF people. Okay. So when you look at the top 10 exonic pentamers, now sorted by G log G over F, they're very purine rich, and they're very similar between organisms. So for instance, these three pentamers are found in both Arabidopsis and Drosophila, and these three pentamers are like down here. They're like in, you know, numbers 11 through 20 or something in human. It's not, so it's just coincidence that that they didn't show up in the top 10 in human, really. All the, you tend to have a very, very similar pentamer composition. This is reading frame, you know, averaging over the different reading frames for exons.
Not taking, is it, I mean, is this entire coding sequence?
Yeah.
So you're not combining these inputs
to the short introns. That's right. This is just, yeah, total coding sequence. It's not surprising that, I mean, we know that the amino acid usage in proteins in different organisms is quite similar. You know, they, most organisms use, you know, 10 to 12% leucine and, you know, 3% this and 4% that. And there's some differences in codon usage, but, you know, I think the amino acid composition is shaping these by and large. And so we think that the components of the splicing machinery that recognize exons, like these SR proteins, may be recognizing these sequences. There's actually some evidence that, you know, like GAA, GAA is sort of the strongest exonic enhancer. And so, you know, we think that some of these are being recognized, and that component of the splicing machinery may be more conserved, you know, in terms of its specificity than the intronic component. And that's, I think that's the end of the, yep. Yes.
So I guess we should break.
We should break and get the cookies, right, before the, yeah. Okay, so I'll just get started. So the second half of my talk, I want to emphasize that I haven't given this talk before. I've had trouble with the some of the graphics, and it's not my work. It's other people's work. It's the work of Tom Stites and Peter Moore at Yale, David, a little bit of David Bartel, some from the Sharp Lab, and a couple other labs. So it's all experimental work. It's not very theoretical or bioinformatics, but I think it's very exciting new things that are being discovered about RNA. Most of them, a couple of these are within the past year or two. And so one of the major accomplishments of the last year in structural biology, or maybe of all time, was the solving the structure of the ribosome, which is the machine that catalyzes peptidyl transferase reactions in the synthesis of proteins. So it has a structure where the tRNA recognizes the mRNA, and then it catalyzes the addition of amino acids to the growing polypeptide chain. So this is going to show you a series of pictures of what the ribosome looks like from, you know, sort of low resolution, you know, and then finer and finer detail. So it has two components. This is a bacterial ribosome, a 50S, or large subunit, and a 30S, or small subunit. And this is sort of what it looks like at a big scale. And this is now at 7 angstroms resolution, showing the tRNAs. So just to give you a little feeling of the scale. And this is what's been known for many years about the composition of the ribosome. The E. coli ribosome is about 2.6 million Daltons. And it's actually largely composed of RNA. So there's many proteins, but also a very large component of RNA. There's several large RNA molecules that compose the ribosome. And this is a view of the ribosome now at higher resolution. And the whitish fettuccine stuff is RNA, and the yellow linguine is protein. And so what you can see from this view, which was only available in the past year, is that basically the ribosome is a big blob of RNA that's decorated with proteins on the outside. So the core of the machine is RNA. And these are just some of the proteins that are known that decorate the ribosome. And an interesting feature of them is that they're not compact globular proteins. Many of them have very weird structures with, you know, long kind of filaments that extend into the RNA core of the ribosome. The two colors represent secondary structure and coil, I think. Not 100% sure on that, because they're not my slides. But the green, certainly these are helices here. No, this is a helix too. No, I'm not sure. Scratch that. I don't know.
The parts that stick into the RNA tend to be positively charged?
It could be parts that are exposed and parts that are buried. That's possible on that previous slide. I don't know much about that. You would think that, well, but the RNA itself has a lot of negative charge.
Right, so I would think the protein might be positive.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I'm not 100% sure on that. The main point I want to make here, since this is not my area of expertise, is that the structure has been solved, and that its RNA, all the interesting parts of it, are made of RNA, and the secondary structures of each of the domains of the large ribosomal RNA subunits have been known for a while based on a lot of phylogenetic analysis. But now we know how they fold in three dimensions. This just shows the, as well as base pairing interactions, the sort of the classical stem loop interactions in RNA. You can also have tertiary interactions called pseudonauts. So you have, say, this is a sort of typical RNA structure. And then you can also have interactions, say, between bases in the loop of this stem loop with other bases, and this would be called a pseudonaut. Okay, and there are many of such tertiary interactions in the ribosome, which have been mapped. And it's now known that the newly synthesized peptide, which is synthesized, the reaction occurs right around here, is then sort of extruded through this long tube out of the ribosome. And it's thought that this has something to do with getting the protein to fold properly. The tube is about 30 amino acids long, roughly. And it's decorated with protein, you can see. The peptide bond, the site of peptide bond formation has now been mapped to the single atom resolution. And it's been shown where that the active site is at a particular adenosine residue of one of the ribosomal RNA molecules. And the most interesting thing is that if you look at where the active site is in the crystal structure, the crystal structure was by Moore and Stites, as I mentioned, the nearest proteins in each direction are, the nearest protein is 18 angstroms away, which is, miles away in molecular terms, and so it's not possible that proteins are catalyzing this reaction. It has to be RNA. So this is just some details of exactly which bases are involved in catalysis. And it's also notable that the active site RNA is the bases involved that are very near the active site were previously identified as being important for ribosome function by a variety of biochemical and genetic approaches. So there were, it was known that certain residues are very important, but now we know for sure which ones are involved in the catalysis. And so why is the concept of an RNA active site interesting? So there's some sort of chemical reasons, which I'm not terribly interested in. And then there are these sort of evolutionary reasons, which I think are much more interesting. And let's show the next slide. And so the proposals for an RNA world gain substantial credibility if the active site, the ribosome, is composed solely of RNA. So have there been any RNA world talks in this series? No. So let me just briefly mention what the concept is. So the puzzle is the origin of life. We know that living things have DNA, RNA, protein, but you need elaborate machinery to replicate the DNA, to transcribe the DNA into RNA, and to synthesize protein from RNA. And it's sort of a puzzle how an organism could spring into life that had all of this machinery to have a DNA, RNA, and protein organism arising spontaneously from random interactions seems implausible. But it doesn't seem like it could arise solely from one of these molecules, certainly not from DNA because DNA doesn't seem is not good at catalyzing chemical reactions. Protein is very good at catalyzing chemical reactions, but doesn't have a way of replicating itself. And so the most plausible candidate sort of ancestral molecule for life is RNA, because it's been shown by Tom Cech and colleagues about 15 years ago that RNA can catalyze certain chemical reactions. RNA molecules that catalyze reactions are called ribozymes, and it also, of course, carries information. And so the idea is that perhaps the first life, if you want to call it life, was sort of a set of self-replicating RNA molecules. And this has been given more credence lately from work by David Bartel at the Whitehead, who has synthesized a ribozyme, an RNA molecule, which catalyzes RNA-dependent RNA polymerase activity, that is, replication of other RNA molecules. And he originally published a ribozyme that did this reaction, but it could only make like one or two nucleotides or something, and so it wasn't terribly convincing. But off the record, it seems like he has a much more realistic ribozyme now. And so the idea is that the first living things may have involved used RNA both for catalytic and information storage, and then later perhaps used protein, and then maybe DNA, or we don't really know, you know, what happened next. But the puzzle about how proteins were created is that now if you have an RNA machine that can make proteins, then it gets around that problem. And so the idea is that maybe the first RNA organisms use, say, peptide cofactors, and then later they or amino acid cofactors, and then later they found that, you know, dipeptides or tripeptides were useful, make better cofactors, so they catalyze a little bit of peptide bond formation, and then later that led to the ribosome. So the fact that the ribosome involves an RNA catalytic mechanism is I think, strong support for the RNA world, and also shows that ribozymes are not just sort of some esoteric thing that are found in a few bacteria or something. They're actually in every living cell has a ribozyme, is dependent on ribozyme activity. And it's also suspected that some other large complexes, such as the spliceosome, which catalyzes RNA splicing, and telomerase, which is involved in replicating the ends of chromosomes, may also be have ribozymes at their core. But we don't know that yet. Oh, no. Okay. So I just want to, in this cool things about RNA talk, contrast sort of the classical functions of RNA, mRNA, which codes for protein, tRNA, and rRNA, which are involved in recognizing and decoding that mRNA and then catalyzing formation of the protein. And then we also know of several other classes of RNA, such as snRNAs, involved in splicing, snoRNAs, involved in ribosomal biogenesis, and other RNAs, which have sort of functions which were worked out mostly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then these can be contrasted with some of the more recently discovered, and now some of these are fairly old by now, but more, they were certainly very surprising functions when they were first discovered, such as reverse transcription, in which RNA is converted to DNA by an enzyme, reverse transcriptase, discovered in the, I think, early 80s. RNA splicing was, of course, a big surprise when it was first discovered, because bacteria, the open reading frame in the mRNA is contiguous, in the genomic sequence is contiguous with the protein, and it's a big surprise that introns are found in higher organisms. Now we know there's a lot of alternative splicing, and Phil talked a bit about trans-splicing yesterday in certain organisms. Other surprising features about RNA are RNA editing, in which you have primary transcript, which, say, has an adenosine at a certain position, and that adenosine is chemically modified, converted to inosine. That one specific nucleotide can be changed after transcription, but before translation, and therefore change the protein that's encoded by that gene. I'm not going to talk about that today. Another surprising feature was the existence of large spliced polyadenylated genes which don't code for protein, like the EXIST gene, which is found on the X chromosome and has been shown genetically to be involved in the process of X inactivation. So female cells have two X chromosomes, male cells have one X chromosome. You need to have equal expression of most genes on the X chromosome in male and female cells. And the way you do this in mammals is you shut down completely one of the two X chromosomes in females. And this gene was identified as being responsible for that effect. And in fact, if you take the EXIST locus and put it onto an autosome that is some other chromosome, it will completely shut down that chromosome. And it was, when they looked at the structure of this gene, it's about a 50 kb primary transcript, which is spliced to about a 17 kb mRNA. The first exon is about 10 kb long. The other exons are smaller. But it doesn't have any open reading frame longer than 100 amino acids in the entire 17 kb sequence. And it was shown that it doesn't even leave the nucleus. It just doesn't ever go to the cytoplasm. So it's clearly not translated. It doesn't code for protein. Functions as a large RNA, somehow shutting down the chromosome. But they don't know the exact mechanism, how that works. And then there are other RNA genes have been discovered. I mean, in addition to tRNAs, ribosomal RNAs, snRNAs, and so forth, there are other sort of more unique RNA genes that function at the RNA level. And this is another problem for bioinformatics, is to try to develop methods to find these genes in the genomic sequence and then figure out what they do. And Sean Eddy is working on that problem, and maybe one or two other people. And so what I will talk about today is a little bit about ribozymes. So for example, the ribosome, some of the methods that are used to study ribozymes. And then a phenomenon is discovered in early 1999 called RNAi, or RNA interference, which involves double-strand RNA. So this is the first ribozymes that were discovered actually catalyzed RNA splicing. So there are introns which can splice themselves out of a message in the absence of any protein. And so that explains probably how introns arose. They were originally parasitic self-splicing elements. Later, the cell, to make that reaction more efficient, evolved proteins to help in the catalysis. And so you can study ribozymes relatively easily, to catalyze new reactions by making a random library of RNA sequences. And this is an experiment that was pioneered by Shostak at MGH and is used heavily by the Bartel lab at the Whitehead and other labs, in which you create a library of random molecules, say 100 bases long or so. And now the goal is to make a ribozyme that will catalyze a particular chemical reaction. Then you devise some sort of selection scheme to select for those RNA molecules in this pool which have a little bit of catalytic activity for that reaction. And here's where the art is in this whole procedure. How do you do that selection and pull out the ones that you want? And then you amplify those that have a little bit of activity and then reverse transcribe them and then amplify them some more by PCR, perhaps under error-prone conditions, so you're actually introducing, you know, a few random changes into the pool, and then you get a set of RNAs which are all similar to the one or two active ones that you pulled out in your first selection, and then you put these through another round of selection and repeat this process 3 times, 5 times, 10 times, and so forth until you get a ribozyme that works.
10 to 15.
Yes.
Is that some sort of random sampling of all the particles?
You generate random RNA.
But it's not exhaustive, it's just some sort of...
Yeah. Yeah, it may not be exhaustive, but it's, you want to sample the space, you know, pretty well.
A little bit more stirring of the pot, so it's often in the
case. Right, right. You pick out a few that are close to the solution, and then you explore the space around the ones that work, and
typical ribozyme is about 100.
They're small, yeah. Gary, please feel free to, if you know more about it.
They're very large. So the camera has a
Yeah.
And the goal here is both to understand the early days of evolution,
right,
and also make practical economics.
Well, maybe. They may put that on their grant applications. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know whether ribozymes are really going to ever be, you know, pharmaceuticals or you know, or used in engineering, you know, applications. But yeah, mostly it's to explore the RNA world and understand the chemistry a little bit better. It's also it's a system. It's an enzymatic system which is much more amenable to manipulation than proteins. You can study RNA evolution. It's much harder to study, you know, protein evolution in, you know, in vitro.
What's the typical function that you select for?
You can select for
replication, or
well, yeah. I mean, this is one example of RNA replication that was selected for. More typical examples are maybe binding to a particular substrate or catalyzing some simple reaction. A lot of reactions involving RNA can be catalyzed by ribozymes. But they have a surprisingly diverse collection of functions. I mean, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 different ribozyme activities have been described.
And is there still a connection between chemical engineering, what they call adaptive evolution, and the food experiments mainly with protein, and
adaptive evolution?
Adaptive
evolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can do this with proteins also. It's just it's a lot easier with RNA. So some of the questions that are being addressed are, I mean, one is, how realistic is the RNA world? You know, there you can sort of theorize about certain chemical reactions that a living system, you know, has to be able to do, and then you can ask, can RNA do that reaction? And that's a common area of research. Yeah. Chemically, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it may not have every, or it may not be completely random, but it's pretty diverse, yeah. Yeah, the Bartel lab does it, Lamowitz, I mean, there are many, there are a couple dozen labs maybe that do this, yeah. Or for fun, you can do it at home.
The hard part is, as I mentioned, is coming up with clever ideas of what to select for and how to select for. Just selecting the binding of the target is an easy procedure. And so you can get lots of RNA very specific. But you basically make RNA antibodies to any protein you want. And that's
okay. So I don't have too much more to say. I just wanted to introduce the concept of ribozymes and mention this CellEx procedure, which is quite interesting. And I wanted to to also mention one recent experiment by David Bartel, which was published in Science last year, which I don't have a picture for, but I can tell you what it is. He was able to, the question is, how do new functions, in a hypothetical RNA world, how do new functions evolve? Is it like we think now, you have perhaps a protein, a gene that duplicates, or maybe goes through some junk phase and then sort of randomly evolves and then acquires, you know, magically some new function, or not? And so the question he was interested in asking is, let's say you have a population of RNA molecules, he calls it a neutral network, where all of these molecules will catalyze a certain chemical reaction and mutations, and with roughly the same reaction rate, and so mutations among them, and they're all, say, a single point mutation away from each other. So you have this network of possible sequences, and you kind of wander around in this space, you can imagine, and then you have, say, some other neutral network of ribozymes that catalyzes some other chemical reaction, and how close are these two in sequence space? Can they be very close? Meaning it would be easy to jump from one ribozyme to another. And he was actually able to construct a sequence, a ribozyme, which can fold into two completely different folds, where there no base pairs are in common between the two ribozymes, and these two folds catalyze two unrelated chemical reactions. So, and I can give you the reference if anyone's interested. But that's the point. And so that he argues shows that in the RNA world you could have perhaps you're kind of drifting around in the space, and then you get close to sort of another space which catalyzes a different reaction. You perhaps then have a molecule which catalyzes both. Then perhaps you duplicate that, and then the two molecules then diverge in function so that one specializes in one reaction, one in another. So that actually normally we think of duplication followed by divergence, but you could actually have sort of divergence in function early and then followed by duplication in an RNA world. And it sort of makes it more plausible that RNA may be an ideal molecule to sort of explore the space of interesting chemical reactions. So again, it kind of sheds more light on the RNA world.
Well, I suppose one of the standard concerns about the RNA world is that RNA is not so stable. What is the canonical reputation of that concern? Turnover time is so fast.
These some of them do, some don't. I mean, but it's regulated by proteins now in the RNA protein world. And
okay.
Maybe the early organisms had a lot of error prone, mutation and stuff. And the 2' hydroxyl,
yeah.
Right. The difference between RNA and DNA is an extra hydroxyl, which is quite reactive, and so it makes it more less stable. Well, maybe it's not reactive under every condition. Maybe under certain pH or temperature or something. I mean, I don't know, Gary.
Maybe there is a kinetic, so they go from one to another.
Sure. Yeah.
Wouldn't one function have had to have been replication?
Organism had to have an RNA replicase. Right.
Right.
So he could explore RNA replication as one of his activities, and then see what you can get. What would the next chemical reaction be that's nearby or something? But he chose two totally unrelated activities and then tried to design a ribozyme that would have both and succeeded. So the idea is maybe they all intersect, or a lot of the reactions intersect.
Did he do it by pure thought, or he did it by the...
things that were easy to select for, I think, or something like that.
He had two ribozymes that had different activities.
Yeah.
He looked at them and saw that he could make a single RNA sequence with a full. I think
he looked at the structures,
a little bit of selection around the design thing. He found one that had both the structures, but neither actually was opposite, but they're down between 10 and 100
fold. Yeah, it's down a couple orders of magnitude. Yeah. But one, you go one or two. Yeah.
That has reasonable amounts of different activities, mostly because it works at the single sequence component. One will than the place. So,
yeah, so they have there's a plot in the paper of the activity. So this is the activity for one of the functions. It's ligation or something, and then this is the activity for the other function. And so you have molecules which differ by single point mutations. So this original molecule was 40 point mutations different from the intermediate. This is the yeah, mutation, yeah. Right, that's right. So in mutation space, this initial molecule that catalyzed ligation ribozyme was 40 changes away from this intermediate ribozyme, which catalyzed both reactions. And then now we're looking, this is the other chemical reaction. And then this one over here, which it started with, it was also about 40 nucleotides away. But he could go by single point mutations, preserving the activity, all the way here to almost the edge. And then when you get to the edge, you drop activity, partly because half the molecules are adopting some other structure and not catalyzing it, and also because you do lose certain ideal nucleotides. But anyway, the two neutral networks come very close to each other in this case. No, they've looked at that, and it's two different structures. Yeah.
Has anybody made a ribozyme with RNA nuclease activity?
I don't know, but I think so.
Yeah.
Most RNA.
In that case, what's becoming a lot of the original ribosomes are RNA
nucleases. Yep.
For example, viruses are RNA replicates the rolling strand. The single strand virus replicates a circle and roll off the wrong thing, and you cut yourself out as a single. Those are all RNA.
I'm wondering how vicious these are in the world might have been, some molecules attacking nothing other than cutting them up and adopting structures that were resistant.
So one idea I've heard, and I'm not going to
just set up the slides. Is this plugged in? No, not plugged in. So I'm done with the LCD and I'm ready for slides. Should I unplug? Is this the... Too bad. Just needs to be. Maybe if someone has a book or something, or put it up there. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's. Is there a remote for the slides? Or should
I? I think there was.
You can.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I have like 8 slides, so it's going to be super quick. Where's my pointer? Okay, so now going to shift gears from ribozymes to another, even more recently discovered phenomenon involving RNA called RNA interference, or RNAi. And this was discovered in 1999 by Andy Fire and colleagues. There's just a classic paper in Nature in 1999 where they describe this phenomenon. They discovered it in the worm C. elegans. This is a picture of an adult C. elegans and a mammalian oocyte for scale. So this is one mammalian cell, and this is, remember, 959 worm cells.
Is it still dividing?
Yeah, it's dividing. Yeah, there's different cleavages happening. So maybe two cells here or something. But of course, an oocyte is a big cell anyway, maybe bigger than a typical mammalian cell, but still. So the Andy Fire discovered this by, they were doing antisense experiments in which you inject the complementary strand to an mRNA into the worm and see if that has any effect on the expression of the protein. And antisense just doesn't seem to work that well, or occasionally it works, but it's kind of unreliable. And it's been hoped that you could just, you know, specifically knock out a gene by making the complementary strand, but it just doesn't seem to work that well. And either accidentally or on purpose, as a control in antisense experiments, you often use the sense strand and inject that. And either accidentally or on purpose, they mix the two strands, the sense and antisense, forming double-strand RNA, and injected that as a control. And it turned out that that inhibited gene function orders of magnitude more than either the sense or the antisense. And they showed for something like 8 or 10 genes which had been knocked out before in C. elegans and had clear knockout phenotypes, like the worm is paralyzed or it twitches in a certain way or it, you know, does this or that. They showed that if you make a double-strand RNA corresponding to a piece of the mRNA, like 300 to 500 bases of the mRNA for that gene, inject it into the gut of the worm. I don't know where the gut is, somewhere here. That you get a phenotype which is very similar to the phenotype of the knockout for that particular gene. Wasn't always as severe as the phenotype of the knockout, and for a few genes it didn't work, but generally you got the complete knockout phenotype, and it persisted into the next generation. The offspring, for those mutations which didn't kill the ability to reproduce, the offspring of the worm also had the phenotype, usually weaker though, but then it didn't last beyond that generation. And you could get the effect even by soaking the worms in RNA. That also works. And even more amazingly, by engineering a plasmid that expressed, that you put a piece of a C. elegans gene in a bacterial plasmid with promoters going both directions, you make double-strand RNA inside E. coli, okay, feed the E. coli to the worms, worms eat bacteria, and you would get a knockout phenotype. So it makes you think about what you eat a little bit more carefully.
A conventional old-fashioned knocking out of the meat is really exciting. How would you do that?
You have some mutagenic agent which, you know, causes mutations or large deletions or something else. Often transposons. It depends on the organism and system.
But that actually doesn't have to be the entire gene.
Yeah, you knock out something that's critical for the gene. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. I'll tell you a few facts that I know about this process, but I won't tell you all the answers that you want to know, probably. And so, just for reference, to make a mouse, a knockout of a particular gene in mouse, takes a graduate student, maybe, 1 to 2 years, typically, something like that. Yeah, you make a construct that has some deleted form of the gene and recombine that with the endogenous thing.
It doesn't excel. The problem is that the reason it's a long time is that it serves lots and lots of potential and you can find the line that works the way you want.
And you have to have some way of selecting for the recombinant and, you know, yeah. Yeah.
Right. How many generations of mice are
involved? Typically several generations of mice, and mice, you know, it takes 6 weeks to reach adult maturity and this and that, and they die and, you know, whatever. And
like the life cycle is
today? What, about a week or two?
Yeah, a couple of weeks.
Couple of weeks, yeah. Yeah, and you can...
Don't you work for the worm?
No. The interesting thing is that it works in many, many organisms. Maybe not every organism, but many, many. It certainly works in Drosophila. It's been shown to work in trypanosomes. Something very similar works in Neurospora. It works in plants. And there's one or two papers in mammals, in mice specifically. And I think even in Xenopus. But there, yeah. It's finicky. Doesn't work very well. Or, yeah. Right. Right. Right, so this phenomenon that we're talking about, RNA interference, is specific inhibition of a specific gene by the double-strand RNA corresponding to that gene. And actually, sometimes it knocks out very similar genes, actually. You'll see that. There's a family of very closely related genes, like 90% identical, that will often knock out the whole family. But then there are sort of more generic responses to double-strand RNA, like the response that Gary was talking about, where in mammalian cells, when exposed to double-strand RNA, often completely shut down all translation of everything. So it's some generic antiviral response or something like that to respond to double-strand RNA viruses, probably.
So for an organism which it works on any gene?
It works on most genes. And it works better in some organisms than others. Like C. elegans is sort of the winner RNAi organism. And Drosophila, it works pretty well, but not quite as well. And then in mouse, it really doesn't work that well at all.
So for genes where it wasn't found to work, have they tried, one hypothesis would be that you're just looking at the wrong, got the wrong double-stranded RNA molecules for whatever reason, not because the messenger RNA might have a secondary structure that just prevents it from being attacked by whatever the gene. Has anybody completely surveyed genes and found that none of the double-stranded RNA constructs will turn it on?
I'm not sure. So this phenomenon was discovered only 2 years ago. Those experiments probably are ongoing, and yeah, there's a number of papers. I mean, the number of papers is growing exponentially about this phenomenon since its discovery, because it's very, very exciting, both because it's a totally unexpected biochemical activity. There must be some cellular machinery which does this reaction, and also because it's a great tool for gene knockouts. It takes maybe a couple days to make double-strand RNA and inject it, and you get the phenotype, you know, within a week. I mean, it's very, very quick. Okay, next slide.
How often do you inoculate double-stranded RNA? Like, imagine that you have two genes which are complementary and more or less similar, just parallel. They can change in principle, they can form double-stranded.
Wow. If one of them was transcribed in the other direction, it would have to be, because you remember, sometimes there is, usually a gene is just transcribed in one direction, and if you had a paralog, even if it was in the opposite DNA strand, it doesn't matter, it's transcribed in the appropriate direction. But sometimes you have an antisense promoter that makes a bit of antisense RNA that could be involved. We don't really know. I mean, it's not thought to happen often, but, you know, we don't. People haven't looked, really. Yeah. Right. They will create some, these overlapping genes, like Phil talked about, will create some double-strand RNA. Yeah. Right. Yeah, those will create double-strand RNA.
Although the messenger RNAs are not overlapping.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, I should emphasize, Andy Fier did the experiment of taking different pieces of the gene and making double-strand RNA. So he took mRNA, and then he also made double-strand RNA corresponding to introns and corresponding to the promoter of the gene, and found that only the double-strand RNA corresponding to the mRNA causes this effect. Okay? The intron double-strand RNA doesn't work. And that suggests that whatever is doing this is happening in the cytoplasm to the mRNA, not to the genomic locus. Or to the pre-mRNA. Yeah. Okay, next. Okay. Yeah, that's close enough. Yeah, great. So this is, I'm going to describe a couple experiments, really, I think, classic experiments on this phenomenon by Tom Tuschel, who is a postdoc in the Sharp and Bartel labs, and now has his own lab in Germany. And he used his goal, so this had been described in vivo in C. elegans, and his goal was to get it to work in vitro in a test tube. And he chose a Drosophila embryo system. They had a Drosophila embryo extract system where they could do in vitro translation. And he did double-strand RNA experiments on an exogenously added gene, luciferase. He had a luciferase is a gene that codes for a protein that lights up, so from a firefly. And he had two different luciferase genes, which were unrelated in sequence, but both lit up, but at different wavelengths, so he could measure the amount of each protein. Okay, so this is one of the luciferase. There's PP luciferase, and then there's another one like RR luciferase, which are two different species of fireflies. Okay, and this is the mRNA. Okay, and he made double-strand RNA corresponding with different different sizes, and added them to these. He would add the luciferase mRNA and then add these double-strand RNAs and see if he could inhibit the activity of the protein. Next. And this is the result that he got. Okay, so he's doing a readout of. They looked at the protein level, and then they also looked at the mRNA level. They measured how much mRNA is remaining for one of these luciferases, for RR luciferase mRNA. Then he would add double-strand RNA for the other luciferase gene, and it had basically no effect on the level of RR luciferase. Okay, and if he added buffer, it also had no effect. The RNA may get degraded, you know, slowly over time in these extracts, so that's maybe why these are slipping down a little bit, but basically very little effect. Whereas if he added double-strand RNA corresponding to the specific luciferase whose level he was measuring, you would see a fairly rapid and significant decline in the level of the mRNA. Okay, and then he repeated this with the reverse, you know, experiment, and it, again, it, you specifically inhibit that particular or destroy that particular mRNA.
The effect on protein expression is much more dramatic because there are many proteins that come out of each RNA.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the kinetics and this and that, and it's, but it turns out that the bottom line of this is that it destroys the mRNA, and that's the effect. Yeah. So, yeah. This is in vitro. This is a Drosophila embryo extract.
Oh, it's cell extract.
Cell extract. Extracts
from. Contains almost everything that cell you. All this, you know,
yeah, you make crude extracts from fly eggs. Everything in the nucleus of a fly egg. And a fly egg has really got a lot of stuff to do translation because eggs have, you know, lots of mRNAs that are from maternal, and then they want to translate them all and make a lot of proteins. And so they're good in vitro translation systems. But they have, yeah, think of it just as a nucleus in a test tube. Okay, next slide. And then they looked at what happened to the mRNA and what happened to the double-strand RNA. And they found that both of them disappear over time, okay? And it turned out that they both get cleaved down to little teeny pieces, okay? Originally, their gels wouldn't resolve the size of pieces that they get cleaved down to. They get cleaved down to 21 to 23 nucleotide pieces, okay? Which run off most gels. But if you make a, you know, high enough concentration gel, or acrylamide gel, you can resolve 20 nucleotides. And they found that they mapped the exact sites where the mRNA was cleaved. It turns out each mRNA is cleaved in particular places, characteristic places, which are 21 to 23 nucleotides apart. The double-strand RNA is also cleaved at characteristic places, 21 to 23 nucleotides apart.
So is it also always the same combination of nucleotides, or is it?
Yeah, it's always basically the same positions, although not exactly. Sometimes it's off by one or two. I have some more slides on that in a second.
But
in
short, yes, it's 20 bars, 23.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are also a couple functional, these LIN RNAs. Which had been genes identified that code for really small RNA molecules that are in that size range, and they don't know if they're related or not.
Does that suggest that the double-strand solution from Citrix, which is recognized by some unknown machine that cut them,
I'll come. That's possible. I'll come to the. Yeah, come to that. I'm not going to go into the details of. Okay. So, and then when they looked at the double, what happened to the double strand RNAs? It turns out that they're not cleaved blunt end. They're cleaved with a two base overhang on either side. Okay. Anyway. And then they call these double strand RNAs siRNAs, small inhibitory RNAs. Okay? Because it turns out that these are actually the active form, that these themselves, if you make these double strand, little double strand RNAs with two base overhangs on each end, those will be active with this RNA interference effect. They will cause the cleavage of mRNAs. But that's very new and like in press and not even described yet. But. That's another very good point. It turned out, so in some systems, it's sort of stoichiometric amounts, roughly the amount of double-strand RNA. To destroy a given amount of mRNA, you have to add roughly that amount of double-strand RNA. However, in C. elegans, it appears to act sub-stoichiometrically, meaning, and they've even shown, at concentrations of a few molecules per cell of the organism, you get destruction of virtually all the mRNAs, many, many more fold mRNAs than double-strand RNA you put in, suggesting that the double-strand RNA somehow has a catalytic, either that it acts catalytically or that it's actually replicated and then, you know, acts or something like that. And there's evidence for actually for both of those. I would say they act catalytically, but I would say maybe they're also replicated. There's some evidence for that too. No. I mean, it's the you make these double strand RNAs with two base overhangs. Yeah, I mean.
Is it the cleavage site, the yellow dot?
Yeah, that's where those are. I think these are the cleavage sites in the mRNA. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, in the mRNA, you cleave in the middle of the two base of the siRNA. Right. Good. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. Okay. So you don't cleave the mRNA in the same place that you cleave the double strand. You cleave it in the middle of that. All right. So this is just a summary of some of the possible connections between this phenomenon, this RNAi phenomenon, and other phenomenons involving gene regulation that we know about. So there's some evidence that it might be involved. It might be an antiviral response, maybe. There's a phenomenon called post-transcriptional gene silencing in plants, which it seemed to be related to. And in fact, if you drip double-strand RNA onto plant leaves, you can often get phenotypes in the plants, knockout phenotypes, even in the roots. So there's a transport mechanism for the double-strand RNA to transport it into other parts of the organism, even in plants. It could be. You could probably, I mean, you know, the DEA could drop, you know, anti-coca double-strand RNA, you know, I mean on the Colombian rainforest. I don't know. So there are a number of practical applications as well as... So the most direct effect of these siRNAs, it seems to be mRNA cleavage, but there's sort of weak and questionable evidence that they might be involved in other phenomena related to gene silencing. Like in plants, it doesn't seem to be just mRNA cleavage. It seems like you actually stop transcription of the gene, so it may have an effect, maybe direct methylation of the promoter or have some other, or maybe rearrange the chromatin in the region of the where the gene is, or something like that. So there could be other effects too, but this is kind of mysterious.
Is there a clear correlation between the organisms
that does work and doesn't work in the gene? Do you know if they have
maturation or the various,
you know,
virus
conditions? Yeah, I mean, it's very complicated, but it seems to work in most eukaryotic organisms. Doesn't seem to work in S. cerevisiae, and it seems to work poorly in mammals, or very non-specifically in mammals. But virtually every other eukaryote, something like this has been observed. Yeah?
So,
there have been two papers about mouse experiments, but everybody and their brother has been trying to get it to work in mouse. And so I'd have to say it doesn't probably work that well. So, you know. But maybe they'll figure out, you know, some trick, you know, that you have to do to prepare the RNA in a certain way, or, you know, something that will get it to work better. They what? Well, actually, they can. Actually, recently, like in the past year, they've figured out how to do homologous recombination in Drosophila. But it doesn't work very well. Okay, yeah. My lab is next to a Drosophila lab, so they say that it works, but they haven't actually gotten it to work yet. But they use RNAi a lot, too. But it doesn't always work. Some genes it works, some it doesn't. You know, so... Okay. And now there are a couple labs that are doing, so Andy Fire's lab, Craig Mello's lab at UMass, Phil Zamore at UMass are doing genetic and biochemical experiments to try to identify what are the cellular proteins or RNA molecules that catalyze this process. And this is an example, the MUT7 gene of C. elegans, which had been shown to be required for transposon silencing, is also required for RNA interference. You knock that out, this RNAi doesn't work anymore. And it's a homolog of the Werner syndrome helicase and RNase D. And the Werner syndrome is a aging disease, premature aging disease. And it makes sense that you would have a helicase. It has helicase activity. It makes sense you would, if you have a double strand RNA that's going to base pair with an mRNA, it's got to open up. And there are helicases which open up double strands. And so that makes sense that a helicase would be involved. And you also need to have some kind of RNA, some kind of endonuclease that can cleave the mRNA. That's also got to be involved.
These are just the components that's needed.
These are components that are required for this process. But
is there more insight of why it should be there and why?
Well, they're just working it out. So let me go to the next slide. There are a couple more components listed, I think. So based on genetic experiments, mostly the genetics is in Drosophila and the biochemistry is in... No, the genetics is in C. elegans and the biochemistry is in Drosophila. They found other genes, RDE1, RDE4, RDE2, MUT7, which have some role in RNAi. And so it's being worked out very actively. My guess is that like in the next year or two, they will have most or all of the components worked out, and we'll be able to. I mean, I think they'd like to get it to work in a purified system where you just add particular known proteins and get this phenomenon to work, to really work out all the details. It's classic biochemistry, but it's just being done in the year 2001. So there's all this technology developed over the years and so forth, and it's a very hot area, so that's it's going to get worked out really quickly, I think. Next slide. And so this is a current model slides from Tom Tuschel for how this phenomenon works. So you have the double strand RNA, you have recognition of the double strand RNA by some protein factors or something. Then you have processing of the double-strand RNA, that is cleavage, leaving these two base overhangs into the hypothetical siRNPs. Okay, they assume that the proteins are involved. I mean, proteins are almost always associated with every RNA, and there must be a protein that cleaves this this RNA here. Then you would the sort of antisense half of the siRNA would then base pair with the mRNA, and then would cause the mRNA to be cleaved. So that's sort of the current model of how it works.
The siRNA inhibitor can get chopped up in the protein. It goes and attaches itself to the messenger RNA, thus targeting it for destruction by other enzymes in the cell?
Yeah, that's the model. Either by, maybe this protein has, can do the chemical, can cleave the mRNA, or maybe it recruits some other protein or something like that. There may be a protein that recognizes this complex, with the siRNA, and then the other. So this might be a triple strand, like you were saying, a triple helix, or it might be something else, or we don't really know.
But is it evident that it's still quite important for it makes triple helix?
There's no evidence that it makes a triple helix that I know of. But it might. I don't think it's been ruled out. Okay, I think that's, if you can just hit the forward button, I think that might be the last slide.
Why is it in the single-strand?
Basically because there's no, I mean, the point is there's an endogenous mechanism that recognizes the double-strand RNA and specifically knocks out the mRNAs, and the single-strand, you know, adopts secondary structure. There is no endogenous mechanism for repairing it.
So if the single-strand goes in, it will match up with the sense, and the same mechanism, something will cut it in two.
You would think, but it may be destroyed before it ever, you know, pairs or something like that. It also, it makes a difference. If you just take, say, sense strand and antisense and mix them and immediately inject, that doesn't work very well. Or inject them separately at the same time, that doesn't work very well. But if you pre-mix them, let them hybridize for an hour or two, then it works much better. So single-strand RNA may just be unstable, and that could be the reason. And a lot of Andy Fire suspects that a lot of when the antisense did work, so the few times that it did work, it was because it was contaminating amounts of sense strand in the antisense preparation. It was actually a double strand effect that they just didn't know, and that could explain why it worked some days, not other days. You know, sometimes you have a little more sense strand, because most of the ways you make RNA involve transcription. That's the most common way to make RNA, and transcription is kind of a leaky process, and often can go in both directions at some low level. So that's the lesson.
It's still very intriguing because this protein that you, or whatever other binding the double strand of RNA, they don't seem like they seek a specific one. They just,
right,
21, 23, look like I want. And still they don't this way, so it's open question.
Yeah, no, it is quite intriguing. Yeah, they would presumably recognize the backbone of the double helix. Yeah. Oh, and I should mention a theory about, the big open question, the many open questions. How does this work? But also, what does the cell normally use it for? What do different organisms use it for? They may use it for different things. One popular theory is they use it to suppress repetitive elements. Okay? So the idea is, say you have a repetitive element, like an ALU or a line. It inserts itself randomly around the genome, okay, many, many copies. Sometimes it's going to get, won't be transcribed. Sometimes it'll get transcribed, but because it lands near a promoter, say. Sometimes it'll get transcribed this direction, sometimes the other direction, because it's landing randomly, and therefore you will make some amount of, for any common repetitive element, you'll make some amount of double-strand RNA corresponding to that, and also some single-strand RNA, and this would be a way of destroying that single-strand RNA before it enables the element to propagate even more, okay? Because they, of course, propagate through an RNA intermediate, which is reverse transcribed. So is that model clear?
Would you expect to see that for repetitive elements?
Yeah, but I'm not sure how strong it could be that it doesn't work well in mammals, and that's what allowed, you know, so many repetitive elements to colonize the genome, or, you know, it's, we don't really have enough evidence to really say that, but it's possible. And T. elegans doesn't have many repeats, right?
Oh, yeah, it does.
Oh, it does, okay, so they're...
They're all the exact parts of, okay.
And they might be sort of selected to avoid this phenomenon, perhaps,
yeah,
or something.
And even if they are being chewed up, that if some call the same state,
it's just a few molecules in the germ cells, you know, get into the germ cells, and it's just, and it acts in catalytic amounts, and yeah, something like that. I mean, or there's some evidence, some genetic screens have picked up RNA-dependent RNA replicases, which could be propagating this, but it's unclear. Yeah, right, cytoplasmic inheritance, right, that's right. So I do want to acknowledge Dave Bartel, who provided a lot of the slides, and also did a lot of this, some of the ribozyme work and some of the RNAi work, and Rachel Green, who provided a lot of the ribosomes lines, and Phil Sharp, who provided some of the RNAi lines, and Lee Lim, who's a graduate student in my lab, who did a lot of the splicing simulation work that I talked about at the beginning. Thanks.